This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Off to Be the Wizard by Scott Meyer, performed by Luke Daniels. 1. Terror. Martin Banks enjoyed science. As a child, he read about people who made huge, world-changing discoveries, and he had wondered what emotions he would feel if he ever discovered something really earth-shattering. Now he had made just such a discovery, and he was surprised to find that the answer was absolute, bowel-loosening terror. Martin didn't consider himself a hacker. He didn't like the image that the label implied. Sure, as a teenager, he'd experimented with the whole pose, but found that rebelling against everything all the time was just too exhausting. It was like an emotional treadmill. It never ended and never got you anywhere, because when you live in a state of constant open rebellion, the powers that be disregard you. So, Martin decided that he wasn't a hacker. He was just a guy who really liked monkeying with computers. Martin was spending the evening his usual way, poking around the internet, seeing what he could get away with. The TV droned away in the background, providing ambient light, occasional distraction, and the illusion of human contact. He knew that many of the things he was doing were technically illegal, but he kept his tampering strictly harmless. That way the authorities wouldn't bother with him as long as more destructive perpetrators were roaming free. He told himself that, but he was too smart to really believe it. That didn't stop him from waking up his computer every evening and seeing what he could see. This night, he was poking around the servers of a cell phone manufacturer that had been in business since the 1930s, when they made AM radios the size of post boxes. He hadn't done anything particularly bad. He didn't have to force his way in. Anyone with a working knowledge of network structure and a willingness to look at a tremendous amount of stupefyingly boring information could have found the file. It was the kind of file nobody would ever look at. 5 terabytes of plain ASCII text characters. Even its name made Martin sleepy. Repository1-C.txt. The moment that Martin thought, no sane person would be interested in a file like that, was the moment he decided to give it a look. He figured it would take far too long to download, so instead he chose to access it directly using a terminal emulator. When it opened, the file appeared to be an endless series of huge, discrete blocks of data. The individual chunks were massive tangles of numbers tossed with rare pieces of recognizable text. He might have disregarded the file entirely if not for the fact that many of the numbers appeared to be changing constantly. He double-checked. This was his default text editor, and it hadn't, as far as he knew, been updated to allow this sort of thing. But there it was. The first thing Martin always did when he found some new data file was to search for his own name. It may seem egocentric, but Martin wasn't worried about that. He had spent a lot of time thinking about himself, and had come to the conclusion that he was definitely not self-absorbed. He searched for Martin Kenneth Banks. Usually a word search on a simple text file took no time at all. Plain text is easy for a computer to work with. Due to the sheer size of the file, Martin's search for himself took nearly 10 minutes. It finally found his name lodged toward the back of the file. He spent over an hour peering at the data, and eventually was able to tease out some recognizable information. Whoever made this file knew a lot about him. He was irritated to find his height was wrong. It wasn't labeled height, it was just the number, but it was unmistakable. 5 feet, 11 inches. It was wrong in that while that might be how tall Martin was if you went to the trouble to measure him, he'd been putting 6 feet 2 inches on every form he'd filled out since high school. He edited the number and hit save. He spent a few moments looking around at various numbers in the file, then got up to go to the bathroom. Martin stretched his arms, stood up quickly, and felt a terrible discomfort in his groin. It was like someone had grabbed the waistband of his jeans and pulled upward. These were his favorite jeans. They'd always been a little tight, He liked pants that constantly reminded you that you were wearing pants, but they never caused him anything like this sort of discomfort. He looked down at his waist. His belt was right where it usually sat, but the inseam of the jeans was definitely riding higher than usual. Also, now that he looked, the hems were slightly higher on his ankles than he'd remembered. Weird, he thought as he pulled his pants down a bit and walked into the bathroom. While absent-mindedly taking a leak, he glanced over at the mirrored front of the medicine cabinet. He saw dust building up on top of the medicine cabinet and thought that he should really clean up there. He didn't dust that spot often because he couldn't see up there. He stared at the dust, letting that thought sink in until he realized his aim had drifted and he was urinating on the wall. The whole time he was cleaning the wall behind the toilet, he was laughing at himself. When he was a kid, occasionally he'd have to leave the house at night to fetch something from the car for his parents. He would always think about how weird it would be if some horrible monster was chasing him, and by the time he returned to the safety of the house, he would be in a dead sprint with his stomach tied in knots. Then he would laugh, because it was ridiculous to think that a monster would be chasing him in his front yard on a well-lit street in the suburbs. This, he knew, was no different. His pants rode up. It probably meant he was gaining weight. Not a good thing, but nothing to freak out about. And the medicine cabinet had probably settled a bit, or one of its support screws had torn free of the drywall, or maybe he was imagining the whole thing. Sitting around all night in a dark apartment with the TV and computer screens providing all the ambient light is bound to affect your perception after a while. When the wall was as clean as it was going to get, he turned his attention to the medicine cabinet. It was still fastened firmly to the wall and didn't appear to have moved. He could still see the dust-covered top, and furthermore, he was pretty sure he had always been able to look himself in the eye when he looked at the cabinet's mirrored front. He remembered the mirror cutting him off about halfway through his eyebrows. He was looking in the mirror now, and all he could see was his nose. He looked at his feet again to reassure himself that he was barefoot. Then he just stood there, being confused. Finally, Martin left the bathroom. He turned on every light in the apartment. He walked out to the living room, kitchen, dining room of the apartment. It was all one space, but you could tell the kitchen was a different room because there were appliances in it. You could recognize the dining room because there was a cheap chandelier hanging from the ceiling over the spot where the architect clearly wanted Martin to put a table and chairs. Instead, the chandelier hung at eye level in empty space behind Martin's desk chair. Martin scanned the room and told himself that he'd always been able to see the top of the refrigerator, and that he was only noticing it now because it was so dusty.
Enough of this, Martin thought.
He went to the bedroom closet to dig through his toolbox. When he moved out of his parents' house, his Uncle Ray had volunteered to drive the rental truck. While watching Martin and his friends carrying Martin's belongings from his comfortable seat in the air-conditioned cab, Uncle Ray noticed that Martin owned no tools. Martin told him,
I've always lived with my dad, so I've never really needed tools.
While you're noticing things, have you noticed that you sitting there in the cab of the rental truck with the motor running and the air conditioning blasting is costing me a fortune in gas?
Uncle Ray said that he had noticed, and that it was fine, and didn't bother him. Later, Uncle Ray gave him a fairly well-stocked tool set as a housewarming gift. The tool set came in its own toolbox. Martin told him,
Thanks! Did you notice that the toolbox is pink and says her first tool kit in sparkly letters?
Uncle Ray said that he had noticed and that this was also fine and didn't bother him. Good old Uncle Ray. That guy was unflappable. Martin returned from the closet with a pink measuring tape and a tiny pink plastic carpenter square. He grabbed a pencil and stood with his back to the jamb of the bedroom door. He placed the carpenter's square on his head and carefully made a mark where the square met the wall. Martin smirked at himself for wasting his time like this as he ran the tape measure up the wall to the mark. He leaned in close to read the measuring tape. The mark met the tape just a touch above the 6 feet 2 inches mark. He repeated the process and got the same result. He thought, Clearly, I've gradually grown 3 inches over the course of the last few years, and only noticed it now, right after changing my height in a weird text file I found online. That's normal. Martin sat at his computer and looked at the file while he thought.
He wanted to just start changing things to show himself how silly he was being, but he also wanted to close the file and pretend he'd never found it, so he just sat there. After 20 minutes of this, he decided he had to prove once and for all that he was being stupid. The cursor was still at the same place he'd left it, at the height notation. Martin edited 6 feet 2 inches to read 6 feet 1 inch. He walked back to the bedroom door. He stood straight and tall with his back against the door jamb. He carefully placed the square on his head and marked its location with the pencil. He methodically ran the tape measure up the wall, taking care to make sure it was plumb, and noted with great interest that his height now measured 6 feet 1 inch tall. He measured himself again. 5 times. He'd have tried a 6th time, but his hands were shaking too badly to make a legible mark. He sat and stared at the TV for about an hour. He had no idea what was on, and he didn't care. He walked back to his computer, re-edited his height to 5 feet 11 inches, and closed the file. He went into the bathroom and splashed cold water on his face. He looked himself in the eye in the medicine cabinet mirror. He went to bed. Not to sleep. To bed. Every light in the apartment was still on, as were his clothes. He lay there and thought about the implications of what had just happened. And that was when he felt the terror. Everyone who paid any attention to science fiction, or for that matter to science, eventually came across the concept that reality as we knew it was a computer program, that people were subroutines, that we weren't biological organisms clinging to a ball of rock hurling around a ball of fire suspended in a sea of nothing, but that we were simulated organisms attached to a virtual ball of rock, located in an unfathomable program that could be a game, a weather simulation, or even a screensaver. Well, not a screensaver, Martin thought. Any society advanced enough to produce a program this sophisticated would have long since developed a monitor that didn't burn in. Once Martin's mental state downgraded from terror to severe agitation, he saw the irony of the situation. Since the beginning of recorded time, man had debated the nature of existence. The greatest thinkers spent their entire lives wrestling with fundamental questions. Even basic discoveries, like the wheel and the lever, had made profound differences in mankind's existence. Now, Martin had proof of exactly what we were, and the means to change things instantly with almost no effort. Martin had, with one accidental discovery, become the most important figure in human history, and he desperately wished he could take it all back. Martin looked at the clock. It was 3 a.m. He'd been laying there, staring at the ceiling and staving off panic for 6 hours. He got up, downed 2 sleeping pills with a double shot of bourbon, turned off the lights, and eventually lost consciousness. 2. The alarm went off at 7. Martin was still under the influence of the pills he'd taken, so while his eyes were open and his body was moving, his brain was not. He showered, he brushed his teeth, he shaved. Usually his brain would have slowly come awake, but Martin was actively choosing not to think. As he walked through his apartment, his eyes locked on the shaky pencil marks on his bedroom door jamb. He stared for a moment, grimaced, and then shut his brain down again. He made coffee and toaster waffles. He glared at his computer as he ate. He read the news on his smartphone this morning. It felt safer that way. He drove his hatchback to work. When he got to his building, he didn't remember anything about the drive. He sat in his cubicle and shuffled paperwork. At quitting time, he realized he could remember almost nothing about his day. He had drifted through it in a haze. He walked to the parking lot, sat in his car, and looked at himself in the rearview mirror. This couldn't go on. He resolved then and there that he would spend the rest of his life pretending that the file didn't exist. He drove home as fast as he could and immediately turned on his computer and opened the file. He'd reasoned that he couldn't pretend that the file didn't exist unless he figured out exactly what it was. He searched for his name again and again found the chunk of data that defined his existence. He knew where his height was, but the other useful metrics proved harder to define. His intelligence, his percentage of body fat, his strength, and his level of health were all impossible to objectively quantify
regardless of what people pitching diet plans said. He found his weight, but dared not change it. He reasoned that weighing less didn't mean necessarily being less fat. He could easily render himself less dense. He could imagine his parents attending his funeral, being asked how their son had died, and having to admit that nobody could explain it, but he'd somehow spontaneously become a foam. Martin took a different approach. He pulled up his banking app on his smartphone and looked up his bank account balance. He searched for that number in the file and found it immediately. He took a deep breath, moved the decimal point one place to the right, and hit save. He refreshed his banking app. His balance read $835. Success! He felt a pang, not a pang of conscience. He hadn't stolen money from anybody. He'd created it out of thin air. The money hadn't existed. Now it did. The way he saw it, he'd done the world a favor. The pang was fear. He knew this was too easy, and if the authorities found out what he'd done, he would be punished, even if it wasn't technically against the law. Martin knew that the burden of proof was on the accuser, so anybody who attempted to prosecute him for electronic bank fraud would have to demonstrate how he did it without accessing the bank's computers. Furthermore, he reasoned, there are two parts to any theft, taking a thing away from its owner and keeping it for yourself. Martin wasn't taking anything from anybody, so he figured it wasn't theft, or at least that he was 50% less likely to get caught. It was flimsy reasoning, but it was good enough to let him sleep. He moved the decimal point back one space and walked away from the computer for the night. Again, he watched TV without ever noticing what was on. Again, he lay in bed without going to sleep. Again, he resorted to over-the-counter sleep aids and inexpensive bourbon to get the rest he needed. The next day was Friday. He sailed through work like the Flying Dutchman. The ship was moving, but nobody was at the helm. His supervisor was concerned that Martin was acting strangely, but he was getting more work done than usual, so she chose not to interfere with a good thing. Martin realized that he couldn't ignore the file. What he'd learned, he could not unlearn. He was just going to have to show some willpower. He put a great deal of thought into all the things he should not do, things that might be possible using the file, but would probably lead to no good. Having spent all Friday collecting dangerous ideas, that night when he sat at his computer, he had no shortage of things to try, and a whole weekend to try them in. 3. First, Martin selected the entire chunk of data that he now believed was essentially him, and copied it to a separate file, which he encrypted and copied to the storage card on his phone. The second thing Martin did was move the decimal on his bank account 3 digits to the right. He considered making himself a millionaire, but why risk it when he could make himself a thousandaire any time he wanted? I have to be careful, he thought. I don't want to screw this up. At first, he wondered how something as complex as a human being could be encapsulated in a chunk of data that was small enough to be managed. But once he calmed down and thought about it, he could see how it might work. He saw that the file was a list of parameters, but not detailed descriptions. He could see the code that defined his heart. He verified this by taking his pulse and watching the numbers fluctuate in real time. The numbers made no sense to him. They might not even make sense to a cardiologist, but they changed predictably in time with his pulse. The code described what the heart was doing and the ways in which it might differ from other people's hearts, but not what it, as a heart, was. It was as if somewhere else there was another file that described human hearts in detail, and every person's data referred to that to render their specific heart. The same went for all the other organs, although this was much less interesting to him once he realized that he had no access to the fundamental structure of his body and could not, for example, transform his skeleton into an unbreakable metal. There were other shortcuts built into the system as well. He ran a search for his current longitude and latitude. He understood the notation thanks to a brief flirtation in his late teens with geocaching, and had access to the actual numbers thanks to his smartphone. When he found his exact coordinates in the file, he decided to move around and see if they changed. He walked backwards slowly while peering at his monitor with an ever-increasing squint.
The numbers appeared to be changing as he moved. So instead of tracking each person's absolute position in space, the system tracked them in relation to the Earth. After the coordinates, there was a number that he saw was his height above sea level. Martin jumped, and though it was hard to read the screen while jumping, he could see that the number changed while he was in midair, then returned to its starting point by the time he landed. Martin knew what he had to do next. If he didn't try, he'd wonder for the rest of his life.
No, that's not true, he thought. I'd wonder until I eventually broke down and tried it anyway, so I might as well try it now.
He hunched over the desk without sitting, swallowed hard, and increased his altitude notation by 1 foot. He exhaled slowly.
Now we see if I can fly,
he said out loud to posterity, posterity in this case being his empty apartment. He hit the enter key. Instantly, he was 1 foot off the ground. Just as instantly, he was falling 1 foot to the ground. Slightly less instantly, his full weight came down hard on the floor and his desk, jamming both of his wrists and twisting his right ankle. He was almost able to remain upright, but eventually fell backward very hard into his desk chair, which bent permanently from the strain and knocked the wind out of him. As he sat, trying to get the air back into his lungs, he could hear his downstairs neighbor hitting her ceiling with a broom and yelling at him to quiet down.
Okay, Martin thought. I can't fly, but I can fall whenever I want.
Martin turned his attention back to the longitude and latitude. He took his smartphone to the far corner of his bedroom and noted the GPS reading. He returned to the computer, sat down, and entered the coordinates. He took a deep breath, hit enter, and he was in the far corner of his bedroom. His feet were on solid ground, but the rest of him was in a seated position with no chair beneath him. His weight came down on his tailbone. It didn't break, but it felt like it wanted to. He took a moment before he got up and walked back to the computer. The downstairs neighbor was hitting the ceiling even harder and yelling even louder. He pictured her trying to get her damage deposit back, claiming the hundreds of broom handle marks had been there when she moved in. This made him smile. He now knew he could teleport. He also knew that he had to put thought into how he'd do it, or he could seriously hurt himself. Again, he looked at the GPS app. He picked a spot about a mile away, a place that would be well lit, but where nobody would see him. The side parking lot of a Boston Market franchise. He entered the coordinates, stood up, bent his knees to absorb any shocks, extended his arms slightly for better balance, gritted his teeth, and hit enter. He was in the side parking lot of the Boston Market. He was glad that he hadn't changed out of his work clothes when he got home, and that his wallet was still in his pocket. He wished he'd kept his shoes on and his keys in his pocket, but he can't have everything. He lived in Seattle, so he was grateful that only the pavement was wet and not the air itself. His computer was still back at home, so he couldn't simply teleport home. Instead, he walked home, eating a bad Boston Market meatloaf sandwich, thinking about what he would do next, both about the file and his spare apartment keys, which he'd left with his downstairs neighbor.
Who better? He thought. She's always home. She pays close attention to what's going on.
His wrists, ankle, and tailbone hurt, but the walk home and the ruining of a good pair of wool socks were totally worth it, both for the time it gave him to think and for the look on his downstairs neighbor's face.
Why are you being so loud up there?
She asked. What do you mean? I wasn't home. I walked to Boston Market. See? He said, holding up his sandwich wrapper and his now empty drink cup. It's exactly 1 mile away, so I've been gone a while.
You could have driven.
If I had my car keys, I'd have my apartment keys.
Why aren't you wearing shoes?
He looked at his feet.
I like to walk quietly. You know that.
How do I know you didn't buy that food earlier than just bring it down here now?
Martin chuckled. What makes more sense? That I ate some fast food, saved my trash, deliberately made a bunch of noise, then locked myself out of my own apartment just to come down here and lie to you for fun? Or that I simply decided to walk a mile without shoes to eat at Boston Market? She had no answer, because neither option made any sense. Martin returned to his apartment, a tired but happy man. He minimized the file for a bit and went to the Android smartphone app store. With some effort, he found a combination of emulators that could pull up the file on his phone. No more walking home, or really anywhere. He had one more item on his mental to-do list. He spent quite a while searching before he found the fields for the date and time. He was past being surprised to find these entries in forms he could easily understand. He figured the program had just passed these concepts onto the people it created as a shortcut. Why spend cycles creating new notation systems when it can just give people ones it already knows will work and get on with rendering trees? He looked at the time notation for a long time. It was essentially the world's most accurate clock. The numbers seemed off until he realized it was Greenwich Mean Time. He was going to try time travel. He couldn't not try, even though he was terrified of the whole idea. He carefully added 30 seconds to the time notation, hit enter, and nothing happened. He double-checked. The time notation hadn't accepted his input. He tried again, with identical results. Martin let out a long breath and said,
"It's probably just as well."
A voice from the corner of the room said, "Try going back in time, not forward." Martin jumped, then looked toward the source of the voice. He saw himself standing in the corner, holding his smartphone, which Martin was also holding. Martin was looking at himself, not a picture, not a reflection. He was seeing him. He'd expected himself to be better looking. They stared at each other for a moment. Finally, time traveler Martin spoke.
"I said you should try going back in time instead of forward."
Original Martin was too busy freaking out to listen and didn't catch what future Martin said.
"What?"
Martin asked, snapping out of it. Future Martin shook his head.
"Great, now I'm confused."
"You're confused?" Future Martin looked irritated. He muttered something under his breath as he tapped at the smartphone in his hand. He looked up once more, made eye contact with Original Martin, and disappeared. Martin walked over to the spot where his double had stood. No scorch marks or anything. Martin didn't know what he expected would happen to the area someone time-traveled into, then away from in quick succession. But he knew he expected more than nothing. Martin looked at his phone and saw the file's time field, ticking off the seconds. He quickly subtracted about 30 seconds from the time and hit enter. The world around him did a fairly fast dissolve between now and the dusty memory that was the world half a minute ago. He saw past Martin standing in the middle of the room, absorbed in his phone screen, looking disappointed. Past Martin exhaled and said,
"It's probably just as well."
Martin felt sorry for past Martin.
"I looked so sad,"
he thought.
"Try going back in time instead of forward,"
Martin suggested helpfully. Past Martin was badly startled. He looked at Martin with genuine panic in his eyes, which quickly cycled through incredulity, amazement, and, to Martin's lasting dismay, disappointment.
"Great," Martin thought. "I'm dumpy looking and easy to read."
Martin decided to try again.
"I said you should try going back in time instead of forward."
Past Martin opened and closed his mouth a couple of times. Finally, he managed to ask,
"What?"
Martin was not impressed with himself.
"Great," he said. "Now I'm confused."
Past Martin looked genuinely affronted.
"You're confused?"
Martin gave up.
"Fantastic," he muttered as he reset the time. "I'm the first man in history to meet himself, and I learned that I'm an ugly idiot."
Martin hit enter and watched his former self disappear as he returned to the moment after he left.
"That didn't go well,"
Martin thought. Upon reflection, he should have expected it. First meetings are always awkward, even if you're meeting yourself.
"Next time should go smoother. I'll have a better idea how to behave and how to react."
Martin heard a quiet,
ahem.
It was right. He looked and was not surprised to see himself standing there, smiling at him.
"I'm you, an hour from now," he said.
"Want to play some heads-up poker?" 4. The next morning, Martin woke up with a hangover. He hadn't drunk much while playing poker with himself, just a few beers. The first round, when he was past Martin, he lost badly. Then he went back in time and played through it all again as future Martin. To be honest, he wasn't that into the second round at first, and had mainly gone back and offered to play out of a sense of obligation. Then he started winning, because he could remember some of the hands past Martin had. Any game is more enjoyable when you're winning, although in the end he broke even. He shuffled off to bed, as tired as he'd ever been in his life, but with his brain firing at full steam. He thought about what would have happened if he'd won the first round of poker, then come back and won again. Was that possible? And if so, where would the winnings come from? Could he create infinite wealth by losing at poker against himself? Of course, he could create infinite wealth anyway by simply moving a decimal point in the file. He eventually realized that if he was going to get any sleep, he was going to have to force the issue, so he downed his now nightly cocktail, two sleeping pills, and a shot of bargain brand bourbon. Now it was morning, and he had a hangover. He sat at his desk, eating toaster waffles and drinking coffee, while he stared at the file. The night before had been a dazzling roller coaster of discovery, but the morning after was, as usual, a grim slog through the bumper-to-bumper commute of reality. He had proven that the file was a tool that could improve every aspect of his life. His aching feet, twisted ankle, and jammed wrists, as well as his ruined socks and his confused neighbor, all proved that he could also ruin his life if he continued to act without thinking first. He had already decided not to change his body anymore. Until he understood the file much better, it was too dangerous. Better to just create money and buy a health club membership, or plastic surgery, if needed. He had also decided that rather than add a huge amount of money to his bank account, he would occasionally add small amounts. He hoped this would help him evade detection. He could fly, briefly. Really, he could place himself in midair for a moment before he fell to the ground. He had an idea of how to fix that, but it wasn't his first priority. He could teleport. This was amazing, but also very dangerous. Happily, his clothes had teleported with him. He reasoned that the file, or the system that used the file, must define your clothes and the things in your immediate possession in relation to your location, just like it tracks your location in relation to the Earth. That was a relief. Martin didn't want to have to explain to the police why he'd materialized naked in a public place. Really, he didn't want to explain to the police why he had materialized at all. He needed to make sure, if he was going to teleport someplace, that in addition to having the right longitude, latitude, and altitude, he would need solitude. He needed a landing zone where nobody would see him. Lastly, he could go back in time and return to his starting point, but he couldn't go forward beyond that. He reasoned that this was because the past was a known state, but the future had not happened yet, and was unknowable and unreachable. He didn't know for sure, and likely never would. The point was, he could go back in time and return to the present. Essentially, he was just teleporting to another time, as well as another place. So, the parameters he needed were longitude, latitude, altitude, solitude, and time. The only way he could do all of these things was to access the file. He could access it from his computer and now from his smartphone. Public computers were out of the question. He couldn't install the software he'd need to securely access the remote computer that hosted the file. It looked like his phone was going to be his primary means of access to the file from now on, so he needed to make sure he didn't transport himself any place that the phone wouldn't work, or he'd be stuck. He pulled up his carrier's coverage map. It was now a map, not only of reliable high-speed data access, but also of the places where Martin had godlike powers over time and space. That shouldn't have felt limiting, but it did.
I can instantly travel anywhere I want, he thought. On this map of the continental United States, as long as where I'm going is in one of the red blobs, the dark red blobs, the lighter ones are iffy.
For the first time since finding the file, Martin Banks thought before he acted. He made a list of things he needed to do before he could proceed, arranged them in a logical order, and started working down the list. He searched the file for his phone's serial number and model name. He was relieved to find them. He was afraid that the file would only cover people, but that clearly was not the case. The file was immense, much larger than even the huge listed file size, but not infinite. And he wasn't sure it was large enough for all people and all objects, but there it was, an entry for his phone. The entry wasn't very large. He supposed, as with people, that mass-produced items like phones didn't need to be described in detail for every copy. Instead, each copy had an entry that described how it differed from others of its type, but the full description of what made it a phone resided in a separate file somewhere else. He spent some time making a rudimentary smartphone app to automatically edit the file. He found the phone's battery level. In the file, it was accurate down to 5 decimal places. On the phone, it was totally inaccurate unless you installed a separate app, which only gave you the reading in whole numbers. He verified that he had the battery level by checking the file against the battery app, then playing a juice-hungry game on the phone for 5 minutes. He rechecked the battery level and was sure he had the right field. He set the experimental app to run in the background, resetting the battery level to 100% every 10 seconds. He played the game again for another 5 minutes. Afterward, the battery was still full. After an hour of searching, copying, and pasting, he had modified his phone to always have 73% battery remaining. 100% would have looked suspicious. This would save him from needing a bunch of spare batteries and carrying them in a bandolier, like Chewbacca. He also made his phone always broadcast to and from an area that was covered by 3 separate cell towers and 2 power substations, no matter where the phone was actually located. It was an intuitive leap, but Martin now understood that the radio waves produced by the phone were just as artificial as everything else and could also be manipulated. And if he could specify where the signal was broadcasting from, he could also specify when. Time, after all, was just another number in the file. He had a harder time trying to reason his way through time travel. In the cold light of day, Martin could see he'd been incredibly reckless in even attempting it. He'd also been incredibly lucky. In theory, once he'd gone back in time, there would have been 2 of them being described by the file at the same time, which you'd think would result in some sort of error, which would be a bad thing. It hadn't, though. Martin had reasoned that there was a program somewhere that accessed the file and used it to render the world, and that the moment he was experiencing at any given time was as far as this theoretical program had gotten. As for travel to the distant past, if reality really was a computer program, then it always had been, which meant that the file had always existed. It was strange to think that the file predated the invention of computers, but it only predated the human invention of computers. Whoever or whatever created the file clearly invented computers long before whatever program Martin was experiencing was written. If the file had always existed, then in a sense, everything in the file had always existed. So really, the only reason Martin hadn't been around through all of history is that the program hadn't been given a reason to render him there. And now Martin knew how to give it that reason. Martin couldn't prove anything beyond the existence of the repository file, but that was enough. He thanked himself for about the 1,000,000th time for having learned to program computers and got to work. When the weekend was over, his app was good enough for the moment. The app had 3 tabs. The first tab's icon was a $. It told him his checking account balance and allowed him to quickly change it. The app made the necessary edits to the file automatically. The second tab's icon was a compass. It used a popular mapping program's API to display a satellite map of the Earth. He could zoom in to look at an area, select a spot, and the app would input the coordinates and altitude into the file. A heartbeat later, he would be there. There was also a dialog box where he could enter a date and time. If he didn't specify a date and time, the app kept him in the present. There was a button to take him back to wherever and whenever he was when he last time traveled. A temporal undo button, if you like. Handy for if he found himself someplace he didn't want to be. He also had a list of places he'd teleported to and from. He could mark certain places and times as favorites to make it easy to get back to them. The 3rd tab was labeled ! That tab had 3 buttons. The 1st button's purpose was to prove to people that he had the power he now had. If he hit it, the app would add 3 feet to his altitude. The button was labeled ! He hadn't figured out a way to alter his altitude and have it just stay altered, so instead his app would re-enter the change 10 times a second, keeping him in the air until he hit the button again. He tried it, and the experience was unpleasant, but nothing he couldn't handle. The second button said home. One press would take him back to his apartment. The third button was bright red and said escape. Martin had given that one some thought. Martin was sure that nothing he'd done was immoral. He hadn't hurt anybody. He just helped himself. He was also pretty sure nothing he had done was illegal. Who writes laws against bending space and time to your will? But he was also certain that if anybody ever found out what he was doing, he would be in big trouble. If he was lucky, they'd just throw him in prison and keep his discovery for themselves. If he was unlucky, he'd be dissected as an alien. He knew that if things went south, he'd need an escape plan. He tried to think of some place he could go where no government or corporation could find him. He knew that in this day and age, that was a problem. But he also saw that was the answer. This day and age, he could escape to the past, and nobody alive today could touch him. He knew that the things the file allowed him to do would seem like magic to anyone who witnessed them. If he was going to escape to a point in the past, it should be a time when magic was believed to exist. That way, instead of people yelling, "Magic! It must be some kind of trick! Let's beat him until he tells us the secret!" Hopefully, they would yell, "Magic! I've heard of that! I've never seen it in person, though!" The trick was finding a time and place where the next sentence wouldn't be, "Let's burn him!" He tried to think of an example from history of a magician who had been revered. The only names he came up with were Houdini and Merlin. Houdini died after he was punched in the gut by a fan. That didn't seem promising. Merlin was King Arthur's wizard, and also probably fictional. Even if a real person had been the germ of the legend, he certainly hadn't had any powers. He was probably just a shaman who was good at looking mysterious. He had parlayed that into a life of some prestige and a legend that had lasted until today. That'll do, Martin thought. Sure, life in the Middle Ages probably wasn't very pleasant, but there was nothing saying he had to stay there. It was just a safe place to go and chill out. If it turned out to be a nightmare, he could always jump further forward in time until he found some place he liked. He did a little research. Very little. He didn't expect to ever use the escape button. He just wanted to have the option. First, he looked into the idea of trying to become Merlin himself. Someone has to do it, he thought. That idea died ignominiously within the first minute of his research. Nobody knew for sure when, where, for how long, or indeed if Merlin had lived. The one thing all of the scholars seemed to agree on was that if Merlin or any of the characters from the Arthur legend had existed, they probably did so in the 6th century. Not a particularly pleasant time to be alive. Martin let that idea go. Instead, he ran a search for the phrase, "the best time to live in medieval England." The third result in the list was a link to the Amazon page for a book entitled The Best Years to Live in Medieval England by Gilbert Cox. Martin read the product description. In this, his seminal work, popular historian and television presenter Gilbert Cox makes his case that the period between 1140 and 1160, placed as they were after the Battle of Hastings, before the murder of Thomas Becket, and well before the Black Death, was the absolute best time to live in medieval England. Good enough for me, Martin thought. He split the difference and set the escape date for 1150, and the place for Dover, because the White Cliffs were the only geological landmark in England he could think of. He considered Stonehenge, but he didn't want to materialize in the middle of a bunch of druids. It was only a precaution. He made the escape button, but he hoped to never use it. As it happened, he used it within 48 hours. 5. Martin was happy to go back to work. After being cooped up in his apartment all weekend, thinking complicated thoughts and wrangling computer code, it was nice to get out and be around people, even if he was just doing data entry. He was still sitting at a computer, but it required no real thought, and he was alone in his cubicle. But that's not really being alone. It's just private enough to lure you into a false sense of security and get you caught scratching yourself somewhere you shouldn't. He drove to work, his car a sunny little island of calm in the middle of the swollen river of misery that was the morning commute. Martin was done worrying about the philosophical implications of his discovery. He had finally come to see it like this. Some say the universe was created by God,
and we are powerless pawns to his whim. Some say the universe was created by random chance, and we are powerless specks in a vast, indifferent ocean. Martin could prove that the world was created by a computer program, which made no difference, because who created the program? God? Random chance? He hadn't answered the question. He had just pushed it back one step. The difference was that people weren't powerless pawns or powerless specks. People were powerless subroutines, or at least everyone was but Martin. Powerlessness didn't seem so bad when you only saw it in other people. Martin had the easy air of a man with a plan. He would continue to live as he always had, but with no money problems and the ability to go wherever he wanted on his days off. He would live a life billionaires would envy, total freedom and total anonymity. And the best part was that he didn't have to change anything. All he had to do was keep a low profile, and there was no profile lower than the one he already had. He would keep his current job, keep his current car, and keep his current apartment. None of them were great, but they could change in time. For now, the way forward was to stop all progress. As he walked into the cubicle farm, it looked different to him. A week ago, he saw it as a fluorescent-lighted, beige-walled abattoir for the human spirit, where he had to spend most of his time. Now he saw it as a fluorescent-lighted, beige-walled abattoir for the human spirit, where he chose to spend most of his time. It was like a corporate drone fantasy camp. He sat, smiling at his desk, humming as he took papers from his inbox, entered the pertinent information from the form into the proper field of the database, then deposited the form in his outbox. He went to the break room. A woman he had known for 2 years without learning her last name was staring at the water cooler. Her first name was Becky. She had a pale complexion and limp dishwater blonde hair that somehow perfectly matched her faded, threadbare business suit.
In its way, it is a cohesive look, Martin thought.
How are you? Martin asked.
Bored,
she replied. Martin said,
I know, right? Everything about this place is breathtakingly dull, isn't it?
Yes.
She looked around to see if anyone else was listening, but they were alone.
Have you ever found yourself hoping just for a second that you'll get into a car accident?
Totally,
Martin said, louder than he'd intended.
Because it would be interesting.
Yeah, nothing where anybody got seriously hurt. I don't want that,
she explained.
No, just hurt enough that you get to go to the emergency room.
Hmm. Maybe ride in an ambulance and have two beefy guys in uniforms help me? A broken arm is the sweet spot. You need immediate attention, and you get out of work for a couple of weeks, but you're not debilitated or anything.
She trailed off, lost in her fantasy. They stood in silence for a minute.
Well,
she said,
I have to go back to work.
I guess you do, Martin said. They don't pay us to stand around talking. She smiled. She had a great smile. Martin had never seen it before. She said,
they certainly don't pay us enough to justify doing our jobs,
as she left the break room.
And she's a manager, Martin thought. If I work really hard, I might get promoted to her job someday.
At noon, as everyone else was going to lunch, Martin was carrying a cardboard box full of his belongings out to the car. Quitting wasn't nearly as difficult as he'd imagined. When his supervisor asked why he was going, Martin said,
I'd rather do something that makes me happy.
His former supervisor smiled the smile equivalent of a middle finger.
Well, with an attitude like that, we don't want you.
His plan was already destroyed, but Martin saw it was a stupid plan. Keep doing something that made him miserable so he could fit in with the miserable people? What he should have tried to do was find some happy people to fit in with. Maybe he could go back to school. He'd hated college so much that he dropped out. But that was when he believed his future was riding on it. Maybe now that he knew it was meaningless, he'd enjoy it. When he returned to his apartment, he saw it as if for the first time. White stucco walls and a beige carpet. If you looked at the floor in broad daylight, you could see the traffic pattern. Faint wear tracks traced the routes from the bed to the bathroom, to the kitchen, to the computer, to the couch. It was time for a lifestyle upgrade. He knew it wasn't necessary, but on a deeper level, he knew he needed it. He'd been good, hadn't he? He'd known about the file for almost a week, and he hadn't done anything with it to benefit himself.
Yes, he'd put $8,000 into his bank account, but he could argue that he earned that money by discovering the means to procure it. Besides, he already had that money. Even if getting it was wrong, spending it now wasn't. It was just the logical conclusion of an act he did days ago. In a sense, it was already done. He made a quick mental list of things he wanted to replace. He figured $8,000 would go pretty far. A day later, he reflected that it had gone pretty far, all the way to the checkout line at IKEA. He had carefully selected his purchases to stay under his $8,000 budget and had just managed it. Looking at the pile of flat pack, he knew he couldn't carry it home in his car. He pulled out his phone, looked at his now single-digit bank balance, adjusted it up to $5,000, and went to rent a truck. Sure, he could have waited for IKEA to deliver his furniture, but having so much stuff delivered at once to such a small apartment might have looked suspicious, and worse, would have required patience. By 5 p.m., his new furniture was in his apartment waiting for assembly. His old furniture was sitting on the pavement behind a thrift store. The truck was returned to the rental agency. Martin settled in for a night of serious furniture assembling. He went to the closet and pulled out her first toolkit. He looked at it in his hand. By 6 p.m., Martin was back with his new toolkit, a massive metal case full of sockets, wrenches, screwdrivers, even a saw. He also had a drill he could use to drive screws. As he assembled the furniture, he mused that unlimited money was like a superpower. It allowed one to do almost anything. Hire a plane to make you fly. Hire a truck to carry heavy things. Hire doctors to keep you healthy. Hire mercenaries to vanquish foes. You could pay someone to do anything. And at the end of the day, you were responsible for having gotten it done. He still hadn't decided what to do with his life. He wanted it to be something of which he could be proud. Maybe he'd create a comic book, hire a writer to flesh out his ideas, hire an artist to draw it. Rich man, he pays people to serve justice. It was an idea. By 11 p.m., he was exhausted, and he slept without assistance for the first time in a week. The next morning, he arranged his new furniture. He started installing his computer on his new desk. He put the 18-inch monitor on the desktop. He put the dusty CPU tower under the desk. He started to hook up the tangle of wires, and he laughed at himself for being so stupid. The closest electronics store opened at 11. At 10 past, he was walking to his car with a new high-end all-in-one computer that looked like a huge monitor with a keyboard attached. Soon it was hooked up and purring like a kitten, and his old computer was running a utility to completely erase the hard drive. He turned his attention to his entertainment center. Martin looked at the large TV cabinet he had purchased, and the smallish TV he had owned for years. An hour and a half later, he was pulling into his parking space with a new TV he'd bought at the second closest electronics store. Going back to the same one would have looked suspicious. He was so excited that he got careless removing the TV's box from the rear hatch and ripped the headliner of his car. Damn, he thought. I wonder how much that'll cost to fix. Buying a new car took longer than buying a new TV. He had saved some time by not making any attempt to negotiate. He'd simply excused himself to use the restroom and adjusted his bank account so he had the down payments. The dealership sales team seemed stunned when he returned from the restroom and asked if they could hurry this up. He was proud that he had the forethought to get a payment plan. He could have paid cash, but that would look suspicious. This way, he was building a credit rating, which would make him look more normal on paper, and in the end, it was all money he was creating out of nothing anyway. Who cared if the interest rate caused him to spend more of it? Also, he could have gone nuts and bought a Ferrari or something, but he hadn't. He just got another bright red hatchback. The sport model. It had a stripe. Got to 75 miles per hour, an eighth of a second faster, and the tires wore out faster while only costing twice as much to replace. He drove home with a dopey grin on his face. He threw his jacket in a heap in the passenger seat and passed the time on his drive home playing with the car stereo at every red light. Martin Banks felt pretty smart, right up until he pulled up to his parking space and saw two men in dark suits. Martin was startled, but reminded himself he had done nothing illegal, as far as he knew, and that there was no reason that these two men would be there for him.
For all he knew, they wanted to tell him about God. He got out of the car and made eye contact with one of the men. It was pretty much unavoidable. The man smiled.
Hello, Mr. Banks. Nice car.
Martin's heart clenched like a fist. His mouth went dry. He looked at the men as if through a long tunnel.
Do you want to talk to me about God?
Martin asked.
Not unless he paid for the car.
The man answered.
6. They took my phone, Martin thought. It never occurred to me that if I got into trouble, they would take my phone.
Martin sat alone in an interrogation room that looked like it could have been made by the set designer from a bad TV show. The only thing that saved it from being a total cliché was that if this were a set, the chairs would look cooler. They'd be stainless steel or something. Instead, he sat on a beat-up wooden chair that was probably older than he was. He was still wearing his weekend uniform. Baggy cargo pants, faded polo shirt, and sneakers. Although they had confiscated his belt and his shoelaces. Again, cliché. The two men had introduced themselves as Special Agents Miller and Murphy, then informed Martin he was under arrest, cuffed him, and stuck him in their unmarked car, which Martin didn't mention was parked illegally. The ride to the station was horrible. Martin figured being under arrest and riding to the police station would always be horrible, but in his case it was worse than for the typical perp. He knew he could easily escape. All he had to do was get his phone out of his pocket, open the app, hit the button, and he'd be at home. He'd be handcuffed, but still, one problem at a time. He considered fleeing for a moment, but decided against it. Martin knew what he had done, and he knew it would be very difficult to prove or even explain without sounding crazy. If, however, he disappeared from the backseat of a police car, that would be easy to explain.
We arrested him. We put him in the car. He escaped.
Martin figured that the method of escape would be seen as a minor detail, unless they somehow figured it out, in which case Martin suspected he'd spend several months answering questions and the rest of his life regretting the answers he'd given. So Martin decided to bide his time, and was pretty happy with that decision right up until they booked him. The first step of the booking procedure was to remove his handcuffs, which he'd liked. The second step was for him to empty his pockets, and that was when Martin knew he was doomed. As reluctant as a man walking to the gallows, he handed over his wallet, his keys, and his phone. The rest of the booking procedure was a blur. Then they'd put him in a holding cell and let him sit there for about an hour. Now he was in the interrogation room. Special Agents Miller and Murphy came in and sat across the table from Martin. Miller was tall and muscular, with a receding hairline. Murphy was average height and doughy, with unruly brown hair. They both looked happy. Miller silently read papers in a manila folder, with Martin's name written theatrically on the tab. Eventually, Miller closed the folder and put it on the table.
Mr. Martin Banks, he said, we're going to ask you a few questions. The more quickly and more honestly you answer, the sooner we can all go home.
Martin considered this. So I may be going home tonight?
Oh, definitely, Martin. You're going to go home tonight. But bear in mind, jail might be your new home.
Ah,
Martin said. Miller continued.
See, my partner Murph and I aren't from Seattle. Heck, until today, Murph had never been to Seattle. Isn't that right, Murph?
That's right.
See, we had to fly out from L.A. on no notice because of you. That's where we live, L.A. Hey, Murph, why do you live in L.A.?
Because I hate rain.
He hates rain, Martin. So you can imagine how happy he was to have to come to Seattle in October. You happy, Murph?
Nah, I ain't happy.
He's not happy, Martin. You got anything to say about that?
Martin stammered. If he were any more off balance, he'd be lying on his side.
I'm sorry?
Murph doesn't want your apology, Martin. He wants answers. If you answer Murph's questions well enough, we can go home tomorrow and maybe get some sightseeing in before the flight. Would you like that, Murph?
Yeah, I'd like that.
Murph wants to go sightseeing, Martin. Maybe see the Space Needle. Or that market you got where they throw great big fish around for no reason. Murph's seen it on the Food Network about 1,000 times.
Oh,
Martin said, mostly out of reflex.
If you do go to the fish market, right next to it there's a little shop that sells the best tiny donuts. You don't want to miss out on that.
There was a silence so thick you could lean on it.
Why?
Special Agent Miller asked, almost too quietly to hear.
Because we're cops.
No, Martin said, an edge of desperation in his voice. They're just great donuts. A little machine makes them fresh, and they give them to you in a...